The reductionist interpretation of values is likely to undermine and erode the enthusiasm of youth. As an example, let me report the following observation. A young American couple who had served as Peace Corps volunteers in Africa returned completely fed up and disgusted. At the outset, they had had to participate in mandatory group sessions led by a psychologist who played a game somewhat as follows. Why did you join the Peace Corps? We wanted to help people less privileged. So you must be superior to them. In a way. So there must be in you, in your unconscious, a need to prove to yourself that you are superior. Well, we never thought of it that way, but you are a psychologist, you certainly know better. And so it went on. They were indoctrinated in the interpretation of their idealism and altruism as mere personal hang-ups. Even worse, they were constantly on each other's backs, playing the "what's your hidden motive" game, according to their report. For a long time, psychoanalysis has understood itself in terms of depth psychology, and depth psychology in turn has seen its assignment as the unmasking of unconscious dynamics underlying human behavior. Perhaps this is best illustrated by what Joseph Wilder once called the shortest psychiatric joke he had ever encountered. Are you a psychiatrist? Why do you ask? You're a psychiatrist. By attempting to unmask the man who had asked him a question, the psychiatrist really unmasked himself. Now, unmasking is perfectly legitimate, but I would say that it must stop as soon as one confronts what is genuine, genuinely human, in man. If it does not stop there, the only thing that the unmasking psychologist really unmasks is his own hidden motive, namely his unconscious need to debase and depreciate the humanness of man. At that point, hyperinterpretation, as I would call it, begins, and it proves to be most dangerous when it comes to self-interpretation. We psychiatrists have met many patients who are suffering from, and crippled by, the obsessive compulsion to analyze themselves, to observe and watch themselves, to reflect upon themselves. The cultural climate that prevails in the United States provides dangerous opportunity for this compulsion to become a collective obsessive neurosis. Just consider a recent study by Edith Weisskopf Joelson and Associates. It shows that the value that ranks highest among American college students is self-interpretation. I see in these findings another indication of the existential vacuum. As the boomerang returns to the hunter only when it has missed its target, so man returns to himself, reflects upon himself, and becomes overly concerned with self-interpretation only when he has, as it were, missed his target, having been frustrated in his search for meaning. What comes to mind is the Freudian's experience with patients in whom, owing to the lack of life content, the psychoanalytic treatment has become a substitute for that content. Now let us turn from the causes to the effects of the existential vacuum, inasmuch as these go beyond both the noogenic neurosis and the feeling of meaninglessness that is to be diagnosed as a sociogenic neurosis. Among the worldwide effects is what one might call the mass neurotic triad, which consists of depression, addiction, and aggression. I once took a taxi to a university whose student body had invited me to give a lecture on the question of whether the new generation is mad. I asked the cab driver to answer that question. He came up with the following succinct statement. Of course they are mad. They kill themselves, they kill each other, and they take dope. As to the first aspect of this triad, depression often results in suicide. And there is ample evidence that, particularly among the young generation, the number of suicides is increasing. Suicide, which once ranked 22nd on the list of causes of death in the United States, now rates 10th, and in some states, 6th. And for everyone who succeeds in committing suicide, 15 will have tried and failed. What is even more important, suicide rates among young people have risen dramatically. While suicide is listed as the 10th leading cause of death in the United States, it is 3rd now among youth 15 to 19 years old, and 2nd among college students. The spreading existential frustration lies at the root of this phenomenon. In fact, a study conducted at Idaho State University revealed that 51 of 60 students, 85%, who had seriously attempted suicide, reported as the reason that life meant nothing to them. Of these 51 students, 48, 94%, were in excellent physical health, were actively engaged socially, were performing well academically, and were on good terms with their family groups. In this context, I would like to quote from a letter an American medical student recently wrote to me. "All around me here in the U.S., I see young people my age who are desperately groping for a meaning to their existence. One of my best friends died as a result of his search. I know now that if he were here now, I could help him, thanks to your book, but he is not. His death, however, will always serve to pull me toward all people who are in distress. I think this is the most powerful motivation anyone can have. I have found a meaning, despite my deep sorrow and guilt, in my friend's life and death. If I can be strong enough in the future as a medical doctor to do my job and fulfill my responsibility, his death will not have been in vain. I want more than anything to prevent this tragedy from happening to others." Small wonder that people who are caught in the existential vacuum are eager, if meanings cannot be acquired, to provide themselves at least with mere feelings of meaningfulness, such as those that are available in that state of intoxication that is induced by LSD. In such states, suddenly the world takes on infinite meaningfulness. But the shortcut finally proves to be a dead end, for it might well be that people who resort to LSD wind up in the long run like the experimental animals used in self-stimulation experiments. Researchers inserted electrodes into the hypothalamuses of rats, and whenever they closed the electric circuit, the rats, to all appearances, experienced either sexual orgasm or the satisfaction of eating. When the rats then learned to jump on the lever, and by so doing to close the electric circuit themselves, they became addicted to the business and pressed the lever up to 50,000 times a day. What I regard as most remarkable is that these animals then neglected the real sexual partners and the real food that were offered to them. And I think that the acid heads who confine themselves to the mere feelings of meaningfulness may bypass the true meanings that are in store for them, to be fulfilled by them out in the world rather than within their own psyches. Since I advanced this hypothesis regarding the real source from which the drug scene derives, numerous authors have written about the feeling of meaninglessness of life as it is reported by young people involved with drugs. Dr. Betty Lou Paddleford points out that the lack of a strong father figure with whom the young male could identify was felt by many authorities to be a precondition to illicit drug involvement. However, the data generated by her own study failed to identify significant differences between the extent of drug involvement reported by students having a weak father image as opposed to students having a strong father image. The subjects studied in her investigation were 416 students, and a significant inverse relationship between drug involvement and purpose in life was found beyond reasonable doubt. R equals negative 0.23, P is less than 0.001. The mean drug involvement index for students with low purpose in life, 8.90, was found to differ significantly from the mean drug involvement index for students with high purpose in life, 4.25. Dr. Paddleford also reviews the literature in the field that, along with her own research, confirms the existential vacuum hypothesis. She reports that Nolis addressed the question of why students were interested in and took drugs. Among the reasons often listed was the desire to find meaning in life. One of the epidemiological studies conducted for the National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse was a survey of 455 students in the San Diego area, made by Judd et al. Users of both marijuana and hallucinogens indicated that they were bothered by and had suffered over the lack of meaning of life more than had non-users. Another study reported in the literature was conducted by Mirren et al., who found that heavy use was correlated with the search for meaningful experience and diminished goal-directed activity. Lynn surveyed 700 undergraduates at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee in 1968 and reported that marijuana users compared with non-users were more concerned about the meaning of life. Krippner et al. Theorized that drug use may be a form of self-administered psychotherapy for people with existential problems, e.g., the 100% positive response to "have things seemed meaningless to you." Sheen and Fechtman found that students who had smoked marijuana regularly over a 6-month period scored significantly lower, P less than 0.001 on Crumbaugh's PIL test than did the non-users. In another area, i.e. the addiction to alcohol, parallel findings were published by, among others, Anne-Marie von Furstmeier, who has shown that 18 out of 20 alcoholics look upon their existence as meaningless and without purpose. Accordingly, logotherapeutically oriented techniques proved superior to other forms of therapy. James C. Crumbaugh measured existential vacuum to compare the outcome of group logotherapy with results achieved by an alcoholic treatment unit and a marathon therapy program. Only logotherapy showed a statistically significant improvement. That logotherapy equally lends itself to the treatment of drug addiction has been shown by Alvin R. Fraser at the Narcotic Addict Rehabilitation Center at Norco, California. From 1966 to the present, he has used logotherapy in working with narcotic addicts. As a result of this approach, he says, I have become the only counselor in the history of the institution to have 3 consecutive years of the highest success rate. Success meaning that the addict is not returned to the institution within 1 year after release. My approach to dealing with the addict has resulted in a 3-year 40% success rate as compared to an institutional average of about 11% using the established approach. As to the last aspect of the triad, aggression, for too long a time, research in human behavior has been based on a mechanistic concept of aggression. This approach still adheres to an old-fashioned, outdated motivation theory that depicts man as a being to whom the world ultimately serves as a mere tool for the reduction of the tensions aroused and created by libidinal or aggressive impulses. However, in contrast to this closed system concept, man is actually a being who is reaching out for meanings to fulfill and other human beings to encounter. And certainly these fellow beings, his partners, mean more to him than just a means to the end of living out his aggressive and sexual drives and instincts. However, regarding the alternative to living them out, that is, the possibility of sublimating them, Carolyn Wood Sharif has warned us of the dangers of harboring an illusion that is so characteristic of all the closed system concepts of man, namely, the illusion that aggression can be drained by being turned to harmless activities, such as sports. On the contrary, there is a substantial body of research evidence that the successful execution of aggressive actions, far from reducing subsequent aggression, is the best way to increase the frequency of aggressive responses. Such studies have included both animal and human behavior. Frederick Werthmann, in his critique of the report to the Surgeon General from the Committee on Television and Social Behavior, ridicules the old getting rid of aggression notion, according to which we need TV violence to relieve violent impulses and thus spare us real violence. Clinical studies have revealed the adverse effects on children and youth of television violence, brutality, and sadism. TV violence was found in hundreds of cases to have harmful effects. The President's Commission on the Causes and Prevention of Violence stated that the constant diet of violent behavior on television has an adverse effect on human character and attitudes. Reduction of violence in entertainment media would, therefore, be of benefit, says Jerome D. Frank. The British Journal of Psychiatry describes an experiment during the course of which children were shown films portraying aggressive acts, and it was found that increases in aggression occurred consistently over and above the initial tendency to behave in that way. John P. Murray of the National Institute of Mental Health summarizes the results of a number of studies as follows. Viewing televised violence causes the viewer to become more aggressive. Again, upon closer investigation, one may find that not only sexual libido thrives in an existential vacuum, but also aggressive distrudo. Statistical evidence is favorable to my hypothesis that people are most likely to become aggressive when they are caught in this feeling of emptiness and meaninglessness. Robert J. Lifton seems to agree with me when stating that men are most apt to kill when they feel overcome by meaninglessness. According to the research conducted by W.A.M. Black and R.A.M. Gregson, recidivists differ significantly from first-sentence prisoners, who in turn differ from normals with respect to purpose in life. P less than 0.0005. The authors conclude that criminality and purpose in life are inversely related. The irony is that the more persistently a man offends, the more likely he is to be sentenced to increasing terms of imprisonment, and the less likely he is to increase his sense of purpose in life, and so the more likely he is to continue offending when released. In the light of such facts, it is understandable that Lewis S. Barber holds that logotherapy is particularly applicable to the treatment of juvenile delinquents. For several years, he has worked with young people in a rehabilitation setting. Almost always, the lack of meaning and purpose in their lives appeared to be present. "We have one of the highest rehabilitation rates in the U.S., Barber says, a recidivism rate of less than 17% against an average of some 40%. This program builds responsibility within each of the boys. It is logo education in practice. That a logotherapeutic approach offers great possibilities to the field of rehabilitation is evidenced by a mean increase in the will to meaning from 86.13 to 103.46, within 4 months at that, among the juvenile delinquents who were subject to Dr. Barber's treatment. How then can psychotherapy at large cope with the mass neurotic triad? How can it tackle depression, addiction, and aggression as they afflict mankind? If we include in the pathology of humanity what really is not neurosis in the strictly clinical sense, but rather a paraclinical phenomenon, we are justified in speaking of a neuroticization of humanity. Now, it is my contention that the deneuroticization of humanity requires a rehumanization of psychotherapy. If one is to overcome the ailments of this age, one must properly understand them. That is to say, understand them as the effects of frustration. And if one is to understand the frustrations of man, one has to understand his motivations to begin with, and especially the most human of human motivations, which is man's search for meaning. This, however, is not possible unless psychotherapy detaches itself from its own reductionism. Everything short of a rehumanized psychotherapy would reinforce the mass neurotic triad. Consider the three aspects of reductionism: subjectivism, homeostasis, and pandeterminism, and let us ask ourselves, if meanings and values really are nothing but defense mechanisms and reaction formations, as the psychodynamically oriented theories have it, is life really worth living? Isn't it rather understandable if I am submerged in depression and wind up with suicide? As to addiction, if man really is just seeking pleasure and happiness by gratifying his needs in order to get rid of the tensions created by them, why worry? Why not build up perpetual and perfect tranquility by simply taking drugs? And finally, regarding aggression, if I really am the victim of outer and inner circumstances and influences, the product of environment and heredity, and my behavior, decision, and action are nothing but the result of operant conditioning, conditioned reflexes, and learning processes, who is justified to demand that I improve or to expect that I change? There is no need for apologies, there are plenty of excuses, there are alibis. And as for myself, I am neither free nor responsible. So there is no reason why I should not continue living out the aggressive impulses about which I can do nothing anyway. From all this, it should be clear that we are in dire need of a rehumanization of psychotherapy unless we wish to reinforce, rather than counteract, the ills of our age. So let us briefly review the path that psychotherapy has taken since the time of Freud, with a view to an exploration of the factors that are likely to account for a dehumanization of psychotherapy. Freud's psychoanalysis teaches how to unmask the neurotic, how to determine the hidden unconscious dynamics underlying his behavior. This behavior is analyzed, and analyzing in this context means interpreting. Later on, however, the assumption of the unconscious was used as a carte blanche on which almost any casual explanation could be written, to quote from an article published in Psychology Today. Explanatory devices, some skeptical therapists argued, as often as not actually cover up rather than reveal the empirical data. In contradistinction and counteraction to the psychoanalytic system, Carl Rogers' approach to counseling is characterized by restraint from being directive and abstention from interpretations, After all, interpretation along the lines of the psychoanalytic system is based on free associations. However, they are never truly free, to quote Judd Marmer. Rather, they are influenced by the analysts, and the patients are indoctrinated in a very specific Weltanschauung, or ideology. According to the particularly Freudian psychoanalytic ideology, man is ultimately nothing but a being ruled and governed by the homeostasis principle. Human love is nothing but the expression of a sublimated and aim-inhibited sexual drive. And as for personal conscience, that is no more than one's superego or the interjection of his father image. It is in this area that Rogers's principal merit lies, for I would say that it is to his credit to have shown us how to de-ideologize psychotherapy. Moreover, in the past 10 years, the prestige of psychoanalysis has dropped significantly in academic and scientific circles, according to Marmer, because over the years, psychoanalysis has been oversold as an optimal psychotherapeutic technique. Whether or not classical psychoanalysis is truly the optimal approach for any specific form of psychopathology still remains to be conclusively proved, Marmer believes, since at best, it is indicated in only a small proportion of cases. Of course, the question may be asked why psychoanalysis still is in a position to perpetuate its theories, proven or unproven. And T.P. Miller offers the following explanation. The voice of dissent is not easily heard in psychiatric America. We are in an era when the sine qua non of publication in many a psychiatric journal is a dynamic formulation of the problem in oral, anal, or Oedipal terms. We are in an era when to disagree with psychoanalysis is more liable to lead to a gratuitous diagnosis and dynamic formulation of the disagreeer than it is to an examination of the arguments advanced. Indeed, by diagnosing the opposition, the ideas advanced are rendered grist for the interpretive mill rather than propositions to be refuted. But can it be that only psychoanalysts have opinions, while the rest of us have problems? Dr. Bernice Moore, chairman of the American Psychoanalytic Association's Public Information Committee, writes in that association's newsletter, "Indeed, there is indication of increasing derogation of analysis in the past few years, and the association has hired a public relations consultant. This," Miller comments, "may indeed be the appropriate action, but it does seem possible that more might be accomplished if psychoanalysis were to undertake to rehabilitate its theory rather than its public image." However, psychoanalysis had already lost much of its territory to a sound and sober trend in the field of psychotherapy, namely behavior therapy. As early as 1960, H.J. Eysenck deplored the lack of experimental or clinical evidence in favor of psychoanalysis. The theories of psychoanalysis are beliefs with which psychiatrists in training are now frequently indoctrinated. However, Eysenck argues not only in general that Freudian theories are outside the realm of science, but also in particular that so-called symptomatic cures can be achieved which are long-lasting and do not produce alternative symptoms. This fact argues strongly against the Freudian hypothesis. In contrast to the Freudian belief, Eysenck thinks that abolition of the symptoms does not at all leave behind some mysterious complex seeking outlet in alternative symptoms. Long before this, logotherapy also had offered evidence that neuroses need not in each and every case be traced to the Oedipal situation or other types of conflicts and complexes, but may derive from feedback mechanisms such as the circle formation built up by anticipatory anxiety. And as early as 1947, I myself attempted to interpret neurosis in reflexological terms when pointing out that all psychoanalytically oriented psychotherapies are mainly concerned with uncovering the primary conditions of the conditioned reflex, which neurosis can be understood to be, and the primary conditions are represented by the situation, outer and inner, in which a given neurotic symptom emerged for the first time. It is my contention, however, that the full-fledged neurosis is not only caused by the primary conditions, but also by secondary conditioning. This reinforcement, in turn, is caused by the feedback mechanism called anticipatory anxiety, Therefore, if we wish to recondition a conditioned reflex, we must break the vicious cycle formed by anticipatory anxiety. And this is the very job done by the logotherapeutic paradoxical intention technique. It is my contention that behavior therapy has made a valuable contribution to the evolution of psychotherapy, in that it has shown how to demythologize neurosis. This formulation is not too far-fetched when one considers the fact that Sigmund Freud himself described his instinct theory as a mythology, and the instincts as mythical entities. To sum up, Freud has unmasked the neurotic, Rogers has de-ideologized psychotherapy, and Isenk, Volpe, and others have demythologized neurosis. And yet a discontent remains. Even to such a declared materialist as Christa Kohler, who runs the Department of Psychotherapy at Karl Marx University in Leipzig, the behavioristically oriented psychotherapists, Volpe and Isenk, are, to her mind, excessively sliding into a biologistic and mechanistic position. She may be right, particularly in an era such as ours, one of meaninglessness, depersonalization, and dehumanization. It is not possible to cope with the ills of the age unless the human dimension, the dimension of human phenomena, is included in the concept of man, which indispensably underlies every sort of psychotherapy, be it on the conscious or unconscious level. Nikolaus Petrilovich of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Mainz, Germany, has drawn attention to the fact that logotherapy, in contrast to all other schools of psychotherapy, does not remain in the dimension of neurosis. What does he mean? Psychoanalysis sees in neurosis the result of certain psychodynamics that it counteracts by bringing into play, say, transference, which to be sure is another sort of psychodynamics. And as to behavior therapy, it sees neurosis as the result of conditioning, of certain learning processes, and counteracts these by means of reconditioning processes, relearning. But logotherapy, as Petrilovich sees it, goes beyond the plane of neurosis and opens up the dimension of human phenomena, thereby placing itself in a position to tap and draw upon the resources that are available in this dimension. Resources such as the uniquely human capacities of self-transcendence and what I have come to call self-detachment. Petrilovich now credits logotherapy for having rehumanized psychotherapy, so that, after the unmasking of the neurotic, the de-ideologizing of psychotherapy and the demythologizing of neurosis, the rehumanizing of psychotherapy has been arrived at, or at least is underway. But now let us come back for a moment to the two uniquely human capacities of self-transcendence and self-detachment. The latter signifies the capacity to detach oneself from oneself. Paradoxical intention, a logotherapeutic technique that lends itself to the short-term treatment of obsessive-compulsive and phobic neuroses, is intended to muster and mobilize self-detachment in general. In particular, however, it utilizes a unique and specific aspect of self-detachment, namely, the human sense of humor. Small wonder that by methodologically including this important facet of man's humanness in its armamentarium, logotherapy acquires an additional asset over behavior therapy. This does not detract from the fact that techniques that parallel paradoxical intention are applied and used in behavior modification. But it is remarkable and noteworthy that Dr. Ivor Hand of London's Maudsley Hospital found that patients who had been treated along the lines of behavior therapy in a group setting used humor spontaneously as one of their main coping mechanisms. Other behavioristically oriented authors, such as L. Solyom, J. Garza Perez, B. L. Ledwidge, and C. Solyom, not only successfully applied paradoxical intention, but also offered statistical and even experimental evidence that it really works, and that the therapeutic results obtained by this logotherapeutic technique cannot be dismissed as the effects of mere suggestion. By and large, obsessive-compulsive and phobic neuroses are psychogenic as opposed to noogenic, so one may say that invoking the human potential of self-detachment is instrumental in the therapy of psychogenic neuroses. Cognizance of self-transcendence, however, is indispensable in the diagnosis of noogenic neuroses. The noagenic neurosis is the effect of a frustration of the will to meaning, which in turn is a manifestation of self-transcendence. Self-transcendence and self-detachment are irreducibly human phenomena and are exclusively available in the human dimension. From this it follows that we cannot really help man in his predicament if we insist that our concept of man be patterned after the machine model, or after the rat model, as Gordon W. Allport mockingly put it. After all, there are no computers that laugh at themselves, nor are there animals that care about meaning and purpose in their existence. The engineering approach to the patient as a machine to repair or a mechanism to fix may by itself be detrimental. It may debilitate the patient's awareness of himself as a free and responsible agent. In other words, it may eventuate in an iatrogenic neurosis, a neurosis that is caused by the physician. Because in this case the doctor is a psychiatrist, one might speak of a psychiatrogenic neurosis. The psychotherapist must therefore re-examine the philosophical underpinnings of whatever approach he adopts, lest he inflict such a psychiatrogenic neurosis on the patient. This is the reason why logotherapy is not only a successful therapeutic procedure in noagenic, sociogenic, and psychogenic cases, but also a prophylactic measure with respect to psychiatrogenic neuroses. We have heard that man is a being in search of meaning. We have seen that today his search is unsatisfied and that this constitutes the pathology of our age. The time has come to ask ourselves, what is the therapeutic approach? In order to answer this question, we must focus first on another one, namely, how does this meaning-seeking being search for meaning? And also, how does he manage to find it? There is no doubt that meaning must be found and cannot be given. Least of all, can it be given by us psychiatrists? We must be satisfied if our colleagues do not take away their patients' meaning and purpose. For example, I recently received a letter that contained the following passage. I have had recurrent depressive states until 2 days ago. A psychiatrist at Harvard University, where I am a student, told me bluntly, "Your life is meaningless. You have nothing to look forward to. I am surprised that you haven't committed suicide." Is this all the help a psychiatrist has to offer? I do not think so. Here is another example to which Edith Weisskopf Joelson of the University of Georgia drew attention. A woman suffering from an incurable cancer was comparing the fullness of her previous life with the senselessness of the ultimate phase. Thereupon, a Freudian psychoanalyst countered that he believed she had made a gross mistake. Her life in general had been without meaning even before the onset of her disease. In reality, the two phases were bare of meaning and sense. To repeat, meaning must be found and cannot be given. To try to give meaning would amount to moralizing. I, for one, think that if morals are to survive, they will have to be ontologized. Ontologized morals, however, will no longer define what is good and what is bad in terms of what one should do and what one must not do. What is good will be defined as that which fosters the meaning fulfillment of a being, and what is bad will be defined as that which hinders this meaning fulfillment. To say that meaning must be found is equivalent to saying that meaning is something to discover rather than to invent. This in turn is equivalent to saying that the demand characteristics, Kurt Lewin, or demand qualities inherent in a given situation, the requirements of the situation, are objective qualities. Thus, meanings prove to be objective rather than merely subjective on empirical grounds. Consider the situation of a subject confronted with a Rorschach test. He is reading into the inkblots an entirely subjective meaning, a meaning whose very subjectiveness betrays the makeup of his personality, as is the case in any projective test. But life, I would say, does not compare to a Rorschach test, but rather to what is called an embedded figure. Here, one cannot simply read a meaning into the drawing, but must find out the meaning that is objectively there, even though it is hidden and therefore still to be discovered. James C. Crumbaugh must be credited with having shown that the discovery of meaning has something to do with a gestalt perception. The will to meaning, he writes, can be comprehended in terms of the gestalt psychologist's laws of perceptual organization, and he relates it to perception, the will to perceive, to read meaning into the environment, to interpret and organize stimulus elements into meaningful wholes. The Gestalt psychologists hold this organizational tendency to be an innate property of the mind. It has survival value, for the greater the range of stimuli which can be comprehended and interrelated, the greater the chance of adaptive manipulation. By the will to meaning, however, Frankl implies a particular kind of perception. Man not only strives to perceive his environment as a meaningful totality, but he strives to find an interpretation which will reveal him as an individual with a purpose to fulfill in order to complete this total gestalt. He strives to find an apologia pro vita sua, a justification for his existence. The gestalt laws of organization, subsumed under the law of pregnance, or filledness, represent an unlearned striving to construct meaningful, unified gestalten from all elements of experience. Frankl's will to meaning can be considered another way of looking at the same concept, though there is an advantage in his thinking, for it is a particularly human idea, pointing up man's distinctive ability to perceive or find meaning not merely in what is, but in what can be. This is the ability which Max Scheler has called the capacity for free contemplation of the possible, and which he considers the factor that separates man from the lower animals. Krumbach concludes by pointing out that evidence favorable to Frankl's postulated drive would be found in the accumulated evidence of the Gestalt leaders, principally Kofka and Köhler, for the Gestalt laws of organization. As previously noted, the will to meaning is primarily a perceptual phenomenon. It follows that if innate tendencies toward perceptual organization exist, it may be claimed that they manifest a striving toward organization of experience into ontologically significant patterns. So meaning must be found and cannot be given, and it must be found by oneself, by one's own conscience. Conscience may be defined as a means to discover meanings, to sniff them out, as it were. In fact, conscience lets us arrive at the unique meaning gestalts dormant in all the unique situations that form a string called a man's life. Insofar as the perception of such meaning gestalts boils down to the interpretation of given life situations, Karl Barth was right when he said that conscience is the true interpreter of life. And if we now ask ourselves by what man is led and guided in his search for meaning, certainly this function is carried out by conscience. Conscience is a human phenomenon, and we must see to it that it is preserved in its humanness rather than being dealt with reductionistically. Reductionism is a pseudo-scientific procedure that either reduces human phenomena to, or deduces them from, subhuman phenomena. For example, conscience is reductionistically interpreted as nothing but the result of conditioning processes. But the behavior of a dog that has wet the carpet and now slinks under the couch with his tail between his legs does not manifest conscience, but something I would rather call anticipatory anxiety, more specifically, the fearful expectation of punishment, and this might well be the result of conditioning processes. It has nothing to do with conscience, because true conscience has nothing to do with the fearful expectation of punishment. As long as a man is still motivated by either the fear of punishment or the hope of reward, or for that matter by the wish to appease the superego, conscience has not yet had its say. Konrad Lorenz was cautious enough to speak of moral analogous verhalten bei Tieren, behavior in animals that is analogous to moral behavior in man. By contrast, the reductionists do not recognize a qualitative difference between the two types of behavior. They deny that a uniquely human phenomenon exists at all, and they do so not on empirical grounds, as one might assume, but on the basis of an a priori denial. They insist that there is nothing in man that cannot be found in animals as well, or, to vary a well-known dictum, nihil est in homine, quod non prius fuerit in animalibus. This brings to mind the joke about a rabbi who was consulted by two parishioners. One man contended that the other's cat had stolen and eaten up 5 pounds of butter. The other contended that his cat did not care for butter. "Bring me the cat," the rabbi ordered. They brought him the cat. "Now bring me the scales," he continued. And they brought him the scales. "How many pounds of butter did you say the cat has eaten?" he asked. 5 pounds, Rabbi," was the answer. Thereupon the rabbi put the cat on the scales, and, believe it or not, it weighed exactly 5 pounds. "Now I have the butter," the rabbi said, "but where is the cat?" He had started with the a priori assumption that if there are 5 pounds, it must be 5 pounds of butter. But is it not the same with the reductionists? They too start with the a priori assumption that if there is anything in man, it must be possible to explain it along the lines of animal behavior. Eventually, they discover in man all the conditioned reflexes, conditioning processes, innate releasing mechanisms, and whatever else they have been in search of. "Now we have it," they say, like the rabbi, "but where is man?" "Conscience is a human phenomenon," I said before, "and therefore must not be dealt with reductionistically. That is to say, on a subhuman level, be it in exclusively behavioristic terms or psychodynamic ones. Nor must a neurosis stemming from the repression of conscience be treated solely on the grounds of behavioristic or psychodynamic concepts. There is a published case of existential depression that was treated by the behavior therapeutic technique called thought stopping. The patient had been suffering from negative thoughts about himself due to negative self-evaluation. Since his depression was considered an existential one, it is fair to assume that it was his conscience that caused the negative responses to his own behavior and even repeated suicide attempts. From this it follows that treating the negative thoughts by thought-stopping procedures amounted to a repression of conscience, which Martin Heidegger taught us to regard as a wired-in existential monitor. The oversimplification is mine. The following is a case in which psychoanalysis rather than behavior modification induced the repression of conscience. Since the summer of 1973, I have been employed as an assistant psychologist by 2 psychiatrists in San Diego. During my supervision sessions, I often disagreed with the psychoanalytic theory that my employers sought to teach me. Yet, as their manner was very authoritarian, I was fearful of expressing my contrary opinions. I feared that I might lose my job. I therefore suppressed my own opinions to a large degree. After several months of this self-suppression, I began to feel anxiety during my supervision sessions. I began to accept the therapeutic aid of some of my friends. However, we succeeded only in making the anxiety problem worse. For what did we do but approach the problem in a somewhat psychoanalytic manner? We sought to uncover the early traumas in me that were causing my transference anxiety with my supervisors. We studied my early relationship to my father, etc., to no avail. Thus I increasingly found myself in a state of hyper-reflection, and my condition grew worse. My anxiety rose to such a level at my supervision sessions that I had to mention it to the psychiatrists in order to explain my behavior. They recommended that I see a psychoanalytically oriented psychotherapist for personal therapy in order to get to the hidden meaning of this anxiety. Not being able to afford such professional help, my friends and I increased our efforts to uncover the deep hidden meaning of my anxiety, and I became worse. I often had extreme anxiety attacks. My recovery began with Dr. Frankl's class, Man's Search for Meaning, on January 8, 1974. I heard Dr. Frankl speak of the difficulties encountered when one tries to psychoanalytically unmask an authentic response. During that 4-hour class, I began to see how the therapy I had undergone had increased my problem, an iatrogenic neurosis almost. I began to see that it was my own self-suppression in the supervision sessions that had caused my anxiety. My disagreement with the psychiatrists and my fear of expressing this disagreement had caused my reaction. I quickly ended the therapy and felt better upon doing so. Yet the real change came during my next supervision session. During this session, I began to express my opinions and disagreements with the psychiatrists when I actually felt such disagreements. I felt no fear of losing my job, for my peace of mind had become far more important than my job. As I began to express myself in this session, I immediately felt my anxiety beginning to decrease. In the past 2 weeks, my anxiety has decreased by about 90%. So conscience is a human phenomenon. However, it can be an all-too-human phenomenon. It not only leads us to meaning, but may also lead us astray. This is part and parcel of the human condition. Conscience may err, and I cannot know for certain whether my conscience is right and another's conscience, which tells him something different, is wrong, or whether the reverse is true. Not that there is no truth, there is, and there can be only one truth. But no one can be absolutely sure it is he who has arrived at this truth. So man can only stick to his conscience, although until he lies on his deathbed he never knows whether it is the true meaning his conscience mediates to him. As Gordon W. Allport so beautifully put it, we can be at one and the same time half sure and wholehearted. Meanings refer to unique situations and the equally unique persons confronting them. In contrast to the meanings, which are unique, values are more or less universal in that they are shared by whole segments of a given population. I would even define values as meaning universals. As such, however, they are subjected to changes, and even more, they are affected by the present decay of traditions. This cultural climate, after all, is reflected and mirrored on the personal level by the feeling of meaninglessness, by the inner void, by what I have described and termed the existential vacuum. Traditions and values are crumbling, but meanings are not, cannot be, transmitted by traditions, because in contrast to values, which are universal, meanings are unique. And as such, they are transmitted, mediated to one's consciousness, by personal conscience. In an age such as ours, in the age of meaninglessness, education, instead of confining itself to transmitting traditions and knowledge, must see its principal assignment in refining the individual's conscience, his only capacity still to find meanings, despite the wane of traditions and values. In other words, the crumbling of universal values can be counteracted only by finding the unique meanings. In an age in which the Ten Commandments are losing their unconditional validity in the eyes of many people, man must be equipped with the capacity to listen to and obey the 10,000 demands and commandments hidden in the 10,000 situations with which life is confronting him. And it is these demands that are revealed to him by an alert conscience. Only then, by virtue of an alert conscience, can he also resist the effects of the existential vacuum as intimated at the outset, namely, conformism and totalitarianism. A doctor cannot give meanings to his patients, nor can a professor give meanings to his students. What they may give, however, is an example, the existential example of personal commitment to the search for truth. As a matter of fact, the answer to the question, "What is the meaning of life?" can only be given out of one's whole being. One's life is itself the answer to the question of its meaning. In other words, morals have to be not only ontologized, but also existentialized. It is a tenet of logotherapy that the humanness of man is grounded in his sense of responsibility. Man is responsible for fulfilling the meaning of his life. Being human means responding to life situations, replying to the questions they ask. Being human means answering these calls. But who is calling? To whom is man responding? These questions cannot be answered by logotherapy. It is the patient who must answer them. Logotherapy can only heighten the patient's innate awareness of his responsibility, and this responsibility includes answering the question of how to interpret his life, that is to say, whether along the lines of theism or atheism. From this, it follows that logotherapy does not at all hover close to authoritarianism, and least of all does it amount to taking over the patient's responsibility and diminishing him as a person. On the contrary, logotherapy can be defined as education to responsibility. However, I would say that at present responsibility must be defined as selectivity. We are living in an affluent society, and this is an affluence not only of material goods, but of various sorts of stimuli as well. We are bombarded by the mass media. We are bombarded by sexual stimuli. And last but not least, the information explosion represents a further new affluence. Heaps of books and journals pile up on our desks. Unless we wish to drown in total, not only sexual promiscuity, we have to choose between what is important and what is not, what is meaningful and what is not. We have to become selective and discriminating. I concluded my address to the 1967 Conference of College Presidents, which was sponsored by the Institute of Higher Education of Teachers College, Columbia University, by saying, I venture to predict here and now the surge of a new sense of responsibleness. The rise of this responsibleness was noticeable particularly among the youth. I saw its first signs in the 1960s protest movements, although I frankly have to confess that much of this protesting was better described as anti-testing, because it was struggling not for something, but rather against something. This is quite understandable, however, because the young people were caught in the existential vacuum. They did not know of anything worthy of being fought for, and there were so many things to be against. However, I was sure that sooner or later they would come up with positive, constructive, and creative alternatives. After all, many tasks were in store for them, waiting to be completed. They had only to widen their horizons and to notice that there was much meaning to be fulfilled around them that would entail and engender a sense of co-responsibility. I remember that in Canada students were fasting, and citizens were invited to pay a certain amount for each hour that a student went without food. The students sent the money to Biafra. At the same time, we had a lot of snow in Vienna, and there was a labor shortage because so few people cared to do the menial work of shoveling snow. Students from the University of Vienna volunteered to do the job and sent that money to Biafra, too. In these examples, I see a growing concern with other people on a planetary level, an increasing sense of worldwide solidarity. The emphasis that logotherapy places on responsibility not only awakens in the patient a growing awareness of his own responsibility, but also precludes moralizing on the part of the therapist. Logotherapy is neither teaching nor preaching. The logotherapist does not, as Rollo May says, supply the patient with his goal. If he ever has, he was no logotherapist. After all, it was not a logotherapist but the psychoanalyst whom F. Gordon Plune described as a moralist first and foremost. And it was not logotherapy but psychoanalysis that was defined by E. Mansell Patterson as a moral enterprise whose central concern is morality. The logotherapist leaves it to the patient to decide what is meaningful and what is not, or for that matter, what is good and what is bad. This abstinence from value judgments, however, is not a universally accepted principle. To quote for a change a representative of behavior therapy, L. Krasner states that it is the therapist who is making decisions as to what is good and bad behavior. Joseph Volpe and Arnold A. Lazarus do not shrink from attacking on rational grounds a patient's religious beliefs if they are a source of suffering. The fact remains that a psychiatrist cannot show the patient what, in a given situation, the meaning is, but he may well show the patient that there is a meaning, and, as we shall see, that life not only holds a meaning, a unique meaning for each and every man, but also never ceases to hold such a meaning, retaining it literally up to the last moment, to one's last breath. The patient then will see a meaning in his life under any conditions. In a word, he will become and be aware that the meaning of life is an unconditional one. What we here embark on is not a value judgment of facts, but rather factual statements about values. What we are engaged in is the phenomenological analysis of the valuing process as it goes on in the man in the street, who has not been exposed to reductionist indoctrination, be it on American campuses or analytical couches, whenever he sets out to find the meaning of his life. And the unbiased man in the street indeed does not understand himself as a battleground for the clashing claims of ego, id, and superego. Nor does he see himself as the pawn and plaything of conditioning processes or drives and instincts. By virtue of what I call the pre-reflective ontological self-understanding, or what is also called the wisdom of the heart, he knows that being human means being responsible for fulfilling the meaning potential inherent in a given life situation. What is even more important, The man in the street knows that meaning may be found not only in creating a work and doing a deed, not only in encountering someone and experiencing something, but also, if need be, in the way in which he stands up to suffering. As we see, the unbiased analysis of the unbiased man in the street reveals how he actually experiences values. Such an analysis is phenomenological, and as such it refrains from any preconceived patterns of interpretation and abstains from forcing phenomena into the Procrustean bed of pet concepts along the lines of a particular indoctrination. Pet concepts such as underlying psychodynamics or operant conditioning. The phenomenological analysis of the man in the street yields those immediate data of experience from which, eventually, an entire axiology may be derived. Specifically, three chief groups of values may be discerned. I have classified them in terms of creative, experiential, and attitudinal values. As a matter of fact, it is only on the basis of this axiological trichotomy that life's unconditional meaningfulness can be maintained. It is through attitudinal values that even the negative, tragic aspects of human existence, or what I call the tragic triad, pain, guilt, and death, may be turned into something positive and creative. Caught in a hopeless situation as its helpless victim, facing a fate that cannot be changed, man still may turn his predicament into an achievement and accomplishment at the human level. He thus may bear witness to the human potential at its best, which is to turn tragedy into triumph. The measure of a man is the way he bears up under misfortune, as Plutarch once put it. Logotherapy is, as it were, trifocal. It focuses on three fundamental facts of human existence: a will to meaning, a meaning in suffering, and a freedom of will. As to the last, man's freedom of choice concerns the freedom to choose not only one's own way of living, but even one's own way of dying. The logotherapeutic emphasis on the potential meaning of unavoidable suffering has nothing to do with masochism. Masochism means accepting unnecessary suffering, but I explicitly referred to a fate that cannot be changed. What can be changed should be changed. Let me illustrate this with an advertisement that was couched in the following verse. Calmly bear without ado that which fate imposed on you, but to bedbugs don't resign, turn for help to Rosenstein, 644 West 161st Street. The phenomenological analysis of the wisdom of the heart of the man in the street discloses that he is cognizant of creative, experiential, and attitudinal values. Further, he knows that attitudinal values rank higher than creative and experiential values. In other words, he also is cognizant of their hierarchy. It is to her credit that Elizabeth S. Lucas offered statistical evidence that the man in the street is fully aware of both the trichotomy of values and their hierarchy. Dr. Lucas based her research on computerized data obtained from 1,340 subjects. Empirical corroboration and confirmation that life is unconditionally meaningful was contributed by some of the several dozens of research projects that have been based on the PIL test developed by James C. Crumbaugh. Thomas Yarnall's study of 40 Air Force servicemen and 40 hospitalized male schizophrenics showed that scores on the purpose in life test are not related to age or IQ. This would fit Crumbaugh's finding of no correlation between PIL scores and educational level. It appears, then, that life can be considered meaningful regardless of age, IQ, or educational level. For the meaning of life is unconditional, ultimately, with respect to outer as well as inner conditions. Eskra Tocqueville and I. Planova of the Department of Psychology, University of Brno, Czechoslovakia, found in their research that unfavorable circumstances in life may, but do not have to, frustrate one existentially. It depends on one's value system, i.e., it is dependent on whether or not one is aware of attitudinal values as a meaning potential to fulfill, if need be. As to inner conditions, Jan Ruch has shown, on the one hand, that individuals with a wide variety of personality traits may experience meaning in life. On the other hand, no personality trait ensures against an existential vacuum. In another study authored by Joseph A. Durlach of Vanderbilt University, a significant negative correlation was found between purpose in life and fear of death, R equals negative 0.68, P less than 0.001. Results thus supported Frankl's notions that subjects who reported a high purpose and meaning in their life tended to fear death less and to have a more accepting attitude toward it. In comparison, subjects who reported less purpose and meaning in their life showed a higher fear of death. It seems to be most important that the recognition of the unconditional meaningfulness of life is not even dependent on our being religious or irreligious. It does not appear, says Durlach, that a belief in a God and in a future existence after death could serve as an explanation for the different attitudes toward life and death found. This is perfectly in accordance with Augustine Meyer's findings. His research study indicates that the educational background and the religious affiliation of the subjects are not related to variations in the mean scores on the PIL. Leonard Murphy had already found evidence to show that people who had chosen God and those who chose another person as their life objective did not differ significantly in their scores on the PIL. Both groups found equal meaning for their lives. In Meyer's study, however, subjects were taken from 5 different religious denominations, and it is his contention that the inability to find evidence to show that subjects differ on the PIL scores on the basis of religious differences gives support to Frankl's idea that God, as experienced by different religious affiliations, can give equal meaning to subjects. In addition, Meyer found evidence to show that sex and PIL are not related variables. The evidence of his study, Meyer believes, supports Frankl's idea that all people are equally capable of finding similar intensities of meaning. More specifically, evidence from Meyer's study shows that the 13 to 15 age group has access to experiential values in particular. The 45 to 55 age group appears to derive meaning in life from the actualization and discovery of creative values. The 65 and over age group derives its meaning from the discovery and actualization of attitudinal values. We psychiatrists are neither teachers nor preachers, but have to learn from the man in the street, from his pre-reflective ontological self-understanding, what being human is all about. We have to learn from his sapientia cordis, from the wisdom of his heart, that being human means being confronted continually with situations, each of which is at once a chance and a challenge, giving us a chance to fulfill ourselves by meeting the challenge to fulfill its meaning. Each situation is a call, first to listen, and then to respond. As I see it, it is the assignment of phenomenology to translate this wisdom of the heart into scientific terms. If morals are to survive, they must be not only ontologized and existentialized, but also phenomenologized. Thus, the man in the street becomes the true teacher of morals. Let me illustrate by quoting from a write-up on the seminars at the University of Chicago's Billings Hospital. Unseen behind a one-way glass, medical students, social workers, nurses and aides, chaplains and student chaplains watch sufferers from illnesses which most often are fatal come to an understanding with death. In an entirely real sense, the patients are teachers, through their own experience, about the end of life.